In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome. So glad you're joining us today here on the iSpy Radio Show. As every week, we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. You know, some years ago, before he passed away, my father-in-law, Ernie, went blind. Being in his 80s, it pained us to watch him struggle to adjust, since there was a lot of times he just felt helpless. Dropping things and not being able to find them, or to try to learn to use a remote with over 20 tiny buttons by touch. So in his care home, he'd have to ring for some help, which he absolutely hated to do. One time when I'd arrived, he'd had to call someone down to help him. He didn't know I was there, but as I watched him interact with a young lady, I smiled as he spoke kindly and gratefully to her, cracking a joke and making her smile, but especially letting her know how much he appreciated her help for something that, to her, might seem rather trivial. Now, Ernie was definitely not a racist. That just wasn't in his character. But this was in the Obama years, when discussions on race just seemed to be getting worse rather than better. So it struck me as I watched him interact with her that, being blind, he had no idea and no means to know what race she was. He was responding to her simply for who she was and her kindness. All he had to go on were her words and her actions and her character. And isn't that the way that we should always treat one another? Close our eyes to what's not important and, as Martin Luther King said, live in a nation where we will not be judged by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. Maybe we'll never get there, because if we were all struck blind, we'd probably find new means and ways to hate people. Maybe we'd hate Sopranos or those horrible tenors. And as I said a few weeks ago, politics is the new racism. The left has revealed that it is determined to yellow star all Trump supporters and destroy them by whatever means necessary. There are even attempts right now by data companies to score people as extremists, using identifiers of such things as registered Republican, likely Republican campaign donor, hunter safety certificate, firearm registration, and so on. The goal of which is to help some companies avoid doing business with Trump supporters. It's all about hating people who aren't like us. And yet somehow the left actually believes they're not racist. Sorry, but hating people who aren't like us is the cornerstone of racism. To hear that a little better, imagine if data companies were scoring people based on race or religion to help companies avoid doing business with them. Maybe that's all coming, and it will, if we don't start standing up. A few weeks back, we told you we'd been introduced to an organization that we could just tell was going to be a goldmine for us, the National Center for Public Policy Research. They have multiple projects, including the Free Enterprise Project with Justin Danhof, whom we interviewed back to back. Today, we'll be talking with two people who are also part of National Center for Public Policy and their Project 21. This has been a leading voice of Black conservatives for over 25 years, whose members have been quoted, interviewed, or published over 40,000 times since its launch in 1992. This is absolutely astonishing. Nadja Enzi is one of those members, and he joins us by phone. Nadja, it's good to talk to you.
Hello, one and all.
So Project 21 is new to us, as are you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in Project 21.
Well, sure. I'm a safety advocate. I grew up in Midtown Savannah, Georgia. Stable, lower middle income Black community. Crack cocaine hit it, and I decided that the greatest threat to everybody around us was not necessarily commuting racists from the suburbs. So that's how I got my start on safety advocacy. Regarding Project 21, like a lot of people, first time I became aware of them was when I saw the initial press conference on C-SPAN in the 90s. Now, fast forward, and I'm the most surprised that I'm actually a member. But what's good about Project 21 is it's a platform for conservative, libertarian, and other right-of-center voices who usually don't get microphones put in front of us by mainstream media. You know, we kind of go against the narrative and consequently aren't often invited. That's why we appreciate platforms like yours.
Well, I loved what you said in an article back in 2014. You were defending Tony Dungy, who at the time was being demonized for saying that he would not have drafted an openly gay football player. And you said this, quote, "Tony Dungy isn't required to prostrate himself at the secular altar of gay rights. Black men are free not to be part of the political correctness choir. It seems any black man who speaks contrary to this trend must be demonized, lest more of his people follow suit." And that last sentence there, attacking people to make an example of them to prevent others from having independent thought, is that why more black men don't become conservatives, that fear of being demonized? And who is that demonization by that concerns them? Is it being demonized by the white media or by the black community itself?
Excellent two-part question, and here is hopefully an adequate two-part answer. Many black people are already conservative. I mean, that's, you know, most of us didn't get it from the Heritage Foundation. We got it from the foundation of our heritage, the folks who raised us, the grandparents we loved, the places of worship we attend, the neighborhoods, at least the stable ones, in which we grew up. But the second part of your question, who does the demonizing, is your friendly or unfriendly neighborhood liberal who says that, hey, you shouldn't be doing things for yourself. You shouldn't support the Second Amendment. You shouldn't support the police, despite every inner city neighborhood association screaming for more, not less police, and for more, not less arrest. They say, no, you shouldn't do that. And unfortunately, many members of our community have decided that being a Democrat is synonymous with being black. And because so much weight is put on one's identity, if you have that particular orientation, you don't want to feel like you're some sort of outcast. So a lot of people are bullied into it. I know a huge number of moderate or conservative folks who vote Democrat who go along with policies they privately don't agree with because they fear being ostracized. And now in the 21st century, where you're not only demonized, but demonetized, and deplatformed, the message is very clear. You either toe the line or you're out.
Well, what do you make of the left's absolute fetish with race? I mean, why are they so focused on race that they just inject it into everything? I mean, we just had the Super Bowl, which I didn't watch. But after Tom Brady won, people immediately attacked him on race. I mean, that winning was somehow due to his white privilege. What is up, you think, with the left's racism fetish?
Well, In the absence of a coherent philosophy, the left will always reliably go to race. Now, they don't acknowledge their racism, which is why I call them granola grand wizards and the Kale Klux Klan, KKK with a spin. They don't look at their racism.
No.
So they will look at Tom Brady. I didn't watch the Super Bowl either, for probably the same reason you didn't. He wins the Super Bowl. That's racist. But spending 4 years burning and rioting over fill in the blank dead black men with the objective not of justice for these dead black men, but to elect a what? Segregationist white man.
Yeah.
They don't see that as racist.
No, it's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, if you see race in everything, you're the racist. So, all right, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll come back. We'll have more with Nadja Enzi. He's with Project 21. Project 21 has been a leading voice of black conservatives for over 25 years and is sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research. We're joined today by Nadja Enzi. He's a member of Project 21. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit in this segment about being a conservative in the black community, just to follow on from some of what we talked about in that first one. Being a black conservative, you're kind of, in some ways, it must feel like you're a minority of a minority. I mean, what's that like, and how did you yourself become conservative? Was there sort of a dawning moment for you?
No, to be honest with you, I always have been conservative. And when I used to wear a dashiki, nobody assumed that I was. You know, this is, again, the dilemma of black authenticity. A lot of us are conservative. A lot of us are moderate. Some of us are even libertarians. You know, we have a segment of dyed-in-the-wool liberals who get all the attention, but they are in no way, shape, or form representative of the community. As far as a eureka moment, I was a political independent throughout my younger days. But then, once again on C-SPAN, because, you know, I predate the internet, so C-SPAN was a big platform back then in the 90s. The Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings.
Hmm.
And I was a political independent, very right-leaning. But when I saw this black Republican, and when I saw those white Democrats, you know, particularly one who happens to be president of the United States now, treat him like he was subhuman.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I saw the people who testified on Justice Thomas' behalf, I said to myself, I think I need to go ahead and stop being independent and become a Republican. Now, this is my personal story. The National Center and Project 21 are nonpartisan. So I'm just merely giving you some backstory on myself. But we're a nonpartisan organization.
Right.
So we don't endorse anybody on either side. But we do discuss ideas and issues. And the issue of black representation in the Justice Thomas hearing showed another side of the black political spectrum that the mainstream media was forced to cover. If they could have not covered this confirmation, they would have. And, you know, when he said high-tech lynching, I thought he was going to get up and leave.
You know, I remember watching those myself and being appalled by them. And my boss at the time, who I didn't usually think of as being particularly conservative or particularly politically active, she was on the phone with me, and we both happened to be watching the hearings at the same time, and there was a moment there where she just paused and said, boy, the likes of Ted Kennedy questioning the moral character of Clarence Thomas is just beyond the pale.
In our system, you don't have to be an altar boy to be a senator.
That's right.
So the late great senator of the left, may God be pleased with them. We understand. This, again, for me, having the platform to see intellectual diversity, ideological diversity in the black community was invaluable. I was an avid reader, so I was already familiar with Thomas Sowell, Jay Parker, and the Lincoln Institute. Just kind of going back a little bit. Walter Williams and a host of others.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, National Minority Politics was a black conservative magazine. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say I'm a fan of all those, Thomas Sowell especially. And in terms of what's been happening lately, because in 2019 and 2020, you had the Blexit movement happening. Being a conservative black seemed to have lost some of its, I don't want to say shame, but some of its stigma, I guess, maybe. Is there really, though, an element of coolness to being a black conservative, that it's cool that you're different and that you're somehow challenging the norm, standing up for what you believe?
Well, now is cool. Because, I come from pretty much, I'm a Gen Xer, so old school policy wonk, you know, person out there in the streets helping people with crime prevention and doing homeless outreach. Nothing glamorous here. But when you get hip young millennials who say that, hey, there's nothing wrong with capitalism, there's nothing wrong with patriotism, that's when we're making the leap. Because everybody is not going to go to the think tank. Everyone pre-COVID-19, obviously, is not going to attend the conference or read the white paper or the monograph or the book. But in a movement like Blexit, like TPUSA, Young Americans for Liberty, Young Americans for Freedom, you know, Students for Life, there's a whole list of millennial-led or millennial-marketed organizations. You know, we've got to engage the younger generation.
Well, in terms of
we have no choice.
Real quick, we only got about a minute here. In terms of that shift there in 2020, where being black seemed to be much more acceptable, was that due to President Trump or was there something else going on?
Let's be very clear. The only reason why one of the parties received a significantly larger percentage of the black vote than before was because of the 45th president. He had a reach that extended far beyond the stuffy confines of country club conservatism or think tanks. Not knocking either one of those forms. I'm just saying, here was somebody who could really engage with a broad percentage of the American populace, and it showed in the voter totals.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. Come back. We'll have more with Nadja Enzi. He's with Project 21. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some crime and homelessness. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Nadja Enzi. He's a member of Project 21, which is a leading voice of black conservatives for more than 25 years. It's sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research, which is how we came to be introduced to him. So, Nadja, we're talking there during the break there. Talk to us a little bit more on the cultural aspects of President Trump.
Absolutely. Again, here was an atypical presidential candidate who did not appeal only to segments of the Republican body politic that pretty much needed political Viagra to get them going. I mean, here was a popular culture figure.
Yes.
Here was a business person. Here was somebody who had been on everything from game shows, no, excuse me, to reality TV shows, pardon me, to even cameos in major movies. Not born. Definitely not someone who bit his tongue. Someone who the average American, regardless of his or her background, in large percentages could identify with. You know, the Republican Party and conservatism have had a problem with messaging. You know, it's nice to be able to be really strong on economic policy and talk about the Laffer curve, but that doesn't necessarily get people. You know, in the 45th president, you had somebody who people really viscerally loved and supported.
Yes.
And he's made an impact that we're going to be studying for decades in the Republican Party and in American politics. And I really think it's not, you know, can't understate that enough, right, going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. Do you think part of the reasons why they are just so hateful of him and this continuing attack on him, I mean, for heaven's sakes, as we're speaking, they're trying to impeach him a second time. Do you think some of that is because of his appeal to the black community, that they have to somehow make an example of Trump?
Well, to be honest with you, I thought the same thing. He had more meetings with, we're not talking about the handpicked few, but genuine representatives of striving, struggling American black people than any president in my lifetime. I'm not knocking anybody. I go back to, I was born in 66, so that gives you the span of presidents that have served in the White House. But you have to try and demonize, because once again, my analysis is that the only group who really should be angry at President Trump would be white liberals, because he blocked their policies at every turn. Logically, I would have thought that a percentage of black voters would have said, well, let's see, low unemployment. And again, and all this was before the pandemic, two time periods, before pandemic, post-pandemic, but, and we'll address the span, but, you know, low unemployment, more representatives of the black community at the table than at any time.
Yes.
More agendas, policies, and daily comments referencing the black community than at any time. This was an atypical Republican, an atypical candidate, and one, the Democrats didn't expect him to win. So when you have somebody you did not expect to win, you have to scramble for 4 years, and now they're going to make it clear that they do not even want him to be able to run against the dog catcher.
Yeah, yeah.
And the National Center is nonpartisan, but these are dynamics which argue very dimly for American politics, period. Doesn't matter which side of the aisle you're on. Because when precedents are set, and people don't understand this when they engage in witch hunts, when a precedent is set, then it's not merely confined to the politician who you don't like. This will go on and be used then in some other form against office holders or former office holders that the current group may not be opposed to.
Well, Trump was making some real progress, actually helping black communities, not just saying he was going to, but I mean, when you look at his support for the historically black colleges, when you look at some of the investment zones and the opportunity zones that he was putting out, it was having some real impacts. And I remember an interview on, I forget where it was, but anyway, they were saying, you know, one of the things that's really something that people are looking at in the within the black community is you had an uncle who was out of job. He was out of jail recently. And now all of a sudden he's got a job driving truck at, you know, $25-30 an hour. And people are really sitting up and taking notice of that. I mean, these are real effective changes within the black community. Do you think that there's going to be a big backlash now against Democrats for their assault on President Trump?
You would think so. But what we found is if your identity is wrapped in a certain party or ideology, then you have to ignore, and it sounds counterintuitive, but you have to ignore any good metrics that do not fit the ideology to which you are enwrapped. So it didn't matter to a lot of black voters and a lot of white voters who chose the current president. Didn't matter what Trump did. Didn't matter what he did to help the country during the pandemic. None of that mattered because it had been decided that he had to go. So he could have parted the Red Sea. He could have made $100 bills rain down from the sky for everybody to scoop up, and it would not matter. This is the toxic political environment into which we find ourselves.
Yeah.
And nonpartisan groups like ours, as well as partisan advocacy organizations, are going to have to navigate this very toxic environment to try to create policy that is going to positively impact the American people.
Well, you know, we had wanted to talk to you about crime and homelessness, and we just don't have enough time, but we'd love to have you back for the, to talk a little bit about that. But real quick, in about a minute or so, and to just maybe tease us for when we have you back, what do blacks think of Black Lives Matter? Are they aware of its Marxist socialist ties, or to use a phrase from polling?
I'm going to be honest with you. Excellent question. And a lot of dyed-in-the-wool black Democrats I know question, well, what's Black Lives Matter doing? Because burning down buildings and destroying business districts do not help black communities. So for stakeholding, stable black folks, all of them are questioning, what are they doing? And guess what? Members of Black Lives Matter are questioning, where have the millions of dollars in donations gone? Because they have not been funneled to all these different chapters made up of grassroots activists.
That is shocking. Okay, like I said, unfortunately, we'll have to have you back on that, especially talk about homelessness. We'd love to get your thoughts on that since it's such a huge problem here in Oregon. Nadir Enzi, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely.
I'd like to welcome now another member of Project 21, Melanie Collette. She is also the host of Money Talk with Melanie and the guest host of Patriot Tonight on SiriusXM. She is an adjunct professor and currently working on her doctorate of business administration and management, something near and dear to my own heart. Melanie, welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We had wanted to talk to our previous guest, Nadir Enzi, who's also a Project 21 member, about Black History Month, but we just flat ran out of time with him. So talking about it is going to fall on your shoulders. So I'd like to read this from a news release from Project 21. Quote, after a year of upheaval dominated by racial division, members of Project 21 Black Leadership Network have declared that Black history is American history. And marking this year's Black History Month, they noted that Americans of every ethnic background have benefited from America's founding values of liberty and opportunity. So would you like to weigh in a little bit on Black History Month?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I love about Project 21 is they allow us the opportunity to have diverse points of view, even though we're all kind of on the same, have the same political leanings and things like that. We still are a diverse people. And one of the things about Black History Month, I enjoy Black History Month and the noting of accomplished African Americans, but I also find it to be one of the most frustrating times of years because some of the celebrations and things like that tend to demonize, I think, tend to demonize white people. And I find that to be a particular irritant if we want to be unified as a nation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's right. So I find that super frustrating.
Well, Nadra had said this. It's important to remember that Black History Month, and this is from the press release, it's important to remember that Black History Month is American History Month. Our story is America's story, and America's story is ours. All races in America must continue to learn and continue making history together. And I absolutely agree with that. I mean, that is America's history. I mean, we are the melting pot. We are everybody's history is makes up the entirety of America. And I think that's what ought to be celebrated.
That is what ought to be celebrated. And when you think about what the original intent of Black History Month was, it started out as Black History Week and then expanded to Black History Month, I think somewhere in 1976, expanded to Black History Month. But the original intent was to have Black history integrated into American history, into the educational curricula. That was its creators, whose name escapes me right now. That was its creators' intent. So that it's all blended into American history. And that's kind of the viewpoint of many of us here at Project 21. But it is indeed American history. And I look forward to a time when we're not saying, oh, look what that person did while being Black. Yes. As if, because it's not, that's not what the accomplishment is, but that's what it's turned into. Mm. The accomplishment is, this, look what this person accomplished who happened to be African-American, who happened to be a Black person. That's what the accomplishment is. And what it's the accomplishment is not, look what this person accomplished despite the fact that they're Black.
Right.
But you know what I mean? As if melanin is some type of handicap. And sometimes when people are celebrating Black History Month, they're doing it from a perspective where Black being Black is some type of weakness.
Hmm. Well, in that same press release, you had said this, that leftists ignore the accomplishment of notable Blacks on the right, like Dr. Ben Carson. They almost exclusively tout Blacks who lean left in their thinking. I find that to be very true. Why do you think that is? I mean, why can't they look at both sides of the political spectrum?
I don't know what it is about their inability to see both sides. Like, you have your Condoleezza Rices, your Colin Powell, who used to be on the right side. but you have all these people who are very accomplished and on the right side of the aisle. Clarence Thomas, Superior Court Justice Clarence Thomas, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. You have all these people who are on the right side of the aisle that are seriously accomplished, and they're completely ignored. And I don't know why the left seems to have that serious blind spot that if you have right-leaning ideologies, then you don't count. And that's another thing that I find very frustrating about Black History Month celebrations. You know, they'll talk about Barack Obama, but they act like Clarence Thomas doesn't exist.
Right.
As if being a Black Supreme Court justice is not a thing.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's not a big deal.
Well, it's like they're... Yeah, really. I mean, it's like they're all about diversity, except diversity of thought. And for some reason, that's the one thing they totally ignore. When that ought to be the most important sense of diversity, is that you do have people of different viewpoints coming together.
That is precisely it. That's precisely it. And I don't know why diversity of thought, diversity of religious thought, diversity of thought on life issues, on abortion, on political issues. You are not allowed to have any type of right-leaning diversity of thought to the left when it comes to Black History Month celebrations. You're just not allowed to do that. And I also happen to be an educator in a high school and in college. And it is really irritating and frustrating to see that constantly happening, to see people on the right constantly ignored as if they've accomplished nothing because they have right-leaning thinking.
No, they're just terrorists now. Overall, do you think that people really pay attention to Black History Month? I mean, it seems like we've got days and months for everything. I mean, this week we literally just had National Cream Cheese Day. Does Black History Month get lost in the shuffle? And what in particular is the response to it in the Black community? Do they welcome it and look forward to it, or is it more kind of a collective shrug?
Oh, no. I think that Black people really look forward to Black History Month. Almost too much. Like, I feel like they look at it as, instead of looking at it as a positive opportunity to celebrate Black accomplishments and things like that. It's a opportunity to demonize other people who are not Black. But in some ways, it's an opportunity to lift Black people up as if they're superior to other races. And that is just that's you're doing the KKK's job for them.
Exactly.
And that may be very incendiary to say, but you really are. They're doing things like creating safe spaces just for Black people, Blacks only eating areas and things like that. And you're going, is this how we really want to celebrate Black History Month?
Yeah. Have they not ever seen pictures out of the 50s and 60s, you know, Black only drinking fountains, that sort of thing?
Exactly. And they're taking us back in history and not in a good way.
Oh, crazy.
And so I think that Black people, the impression that I get is that most Black people really look forward to Black History Month. It doesn't get lost in the shuffle. I think that there are many of us who are right leaning and other races look at it with an eye roll and a shrug. Like here it comes again. I mean, I tend to make fun of it. I call it Woke History Month because a lot of it tends to be this leftist, you know, sense of wokeness that you have to have during Black History Month.
Yeah,
everything has to. I mean, there was some tweet, probably was, I hope that it was fake, but it said, how dare Tom Brady win a Super Bowl during Black History Month?
I know. Because that was a real tweet. I've seen several like that. Oh, okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. In addition to being a member of Project 21, a talk show host and a PhD candidate, Melanie is writing a series of books called The Angry Educator. There's a lot of people angry at educators right now, so we're going to talk all about that coming up next. And welcome back. We're talking today with Melanie Colette. She is a member of Project 21, an organization that has been a leading voice of Black conservatives for over 25 years. It is sponsored by the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about Project 21 by heading to nationalcenter.org, and Project 21 is under the Programs tab at the top of the page. Melanie, going out of that break, I mentioned that you're working on a series of books called The Angry Educator, which will be a revealing look at public education from the perspective of a Christian conservative with 20 years of experience in education. And education is definitely very near and dear to our hearts here at iSpy Radio. I'm all but dissertation on my doctorate, and my program had a special focus on teaching. My producer holds a master's in education focused on public policy. So tell us about your book and a book series and what it's going to be about.
So what it's going to be about is the many different areas of education that where there are conflicts with Christian conservatism, and there are many. It's being really taken over by the left.
Yes.
And it's not something that just started out. And I think that, you know, many parents, I think I belong to a secret Facebook group called Conservative Educators of America. And there's tons of us who are secretly conservative, but we're so afraid to speak publicly. I lost a job one time because of being a conservative. Literally, my boss walked up to me, marched up to me while I was on a cafeteria duty and said, "How can you be in the GOP and be a teacher?" And I was like, "Well, how did you know?" He's like, "I saw your Facebook page." And my Facebook, at the time I was running for election. Interestingly, I told them that I was heavily involved in politics, but I just never told them that I was a Republican.
Oh, so they just assumed you're a Democrat.
Ah, yes, indeed. So they assumed that the brown girl who's a teacher is obviously a Democrat.
Which itself is a very racist way of thinking, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Indeed, it is. So there's that. There's many parts of teaching. There's another. The reason why it's going to be a series of books is because there's another aspect of teaching that goes against all our conservative principles. The education as a whole is going downhill.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of it is because of the union. Because of the union, you have to follow the money. The teachers' unions. I could write a whole book just on teachers' unions and why that's such a problem. The grading scales, the IEPs, the 504s, and not that I have anything against special education or educating kids with special needs, but are we really helping these kids? Are kids being classified the way they should be classified? And are we really helping them with things like no zero grading policies and things like that? These are things that I've come up against in the education field. For example, I had one principal tell me that the reason why we have no zero grading policies is because some kids start off on first base while other kids start off on third base, particularly our kids who are African American and struggling. Now, I felt as though that was kind of a racist thing to say.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And quite frankly, I said, well, why aren't we helping these kids with resiliency? Why aren't we helping fill in the gaps where they need help, rather than just saying, instead of giving them a zero, giving them a 55 when they really earned a zero, giving them a 70 when they really earned a 65. These are the kinds of things that we're doing. And consequently, kids are not learning. Mm-hmm. So there's just and not to mention the straight up indoctrination that goes on with climate change, LGBTQ.
Oh, absolutely.
All those things that go on. Anti-gun rhetoric that goes on. Just all kinds of things that goes on in education that I think parents would be shocked if they're not paying attention to learn. That goes on in our public schools that their money is paying for.
Sure, absolutely. You know, we're spending more than ever for even poorer results. And, you know, bless our hearts, I think a lot of parents just kind of approach things with the assumption that their kids are actually being taught and the grades that they're getting somehow reflects that. Does national testing cause some of the grade shifts to make these educational quotas that teachers need to show achievement? I mean, is that part of the problem?
I think that is part of the problem, but I think the bigger problem is attrition and money. And this is what I mean about it being highly illegal. If money is attached to student attrition, if it's attached to how many kids that we have in the school, right? And we're cooking the books and saying, well, we're not going to fail these kids. We're going to pass these kids along and not have them get kicked out of school for not achieving what they're supposed to be achieving. How is that not illegal? How is that not like a RICO scheme?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what I was thinking when you were saying that. I said, if you're doing that in your business and doing that on your taxes, you'd go to jail for it.
Exactly. And we do the exact same thing in education. Our budgets are based on how many kids we have in each school and how many kids we have in each school are in large part based on our grading. And if a kid gets expelled from school, and kids hardly get expelled from school for behavior either, that's a whole nother series. That's a whole nother book in the series about the behavior and things that we tolerate in a public school that's never tolerated in a private school or a charter school. Mm-hmm. And causes kids to, you have to do something really dangerous, really horrible to get expelled from high school. And that's part of the reason why public schools have such problems as they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's actually take a little break a little bit early here because I've got a couple of big questions for you. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Melanie after this. Back in our final segment with Melanie Collette. She's a member of Project 21, which has been a leading voice of a leading voice for black conservatives for over 25 years. It is a program of the National Center for Public Policy Research. She's also a PhD student pursuing her doctorate of business administration and is currently working on a series of books, The Angry Educator. And in that last break there, having gone through teaching-oriented school myself, one of the things that you learn is that there is an absolute glut of available teachers out there who are never able to land a teaching gig. And with your background in business, in and out of the classroom, I'm sure you know that successful entrepreneurs look for opportunities where others can't or don't see them. So maybe COVID, this whole pandemic, represents an opportunity rather than just a tragedy. Let me run something by you. Oregon spends a whopping $14,000 per student. And just imagine if every penny of that money followed the student rather than being paid to the school district. I mean, for example, a family of three kids, a mom or dad could stay home and homeschool and get paid $42,000 per year. Even just two kids, that's $28,000 per year, which is near the holy grail of minimum wage at $15 an hour. Plus, there's no overhead to the system of costly classrooms, building maintenance, etc. No polluting buses. Or on a neighborhood basis, someone with an unused teaching degree could open their home or maybe rent some nearby commercial space that is currently sitting empty and take in, say, 10 kids. $140,000 per year is way more than they would ever make in a teacher's union-run school classroom. They could even hire some of the kids' parents to prepare healthy meals, help out in the classroom, and so on. I just look at this, and I think COVID doesn't have to be a scourge on society. It's certainly exposing some of the flaws within the educational system, so let's maybe look for new opportunities rather than to be enslaved to the whims of a system that many people believe are failing our kids anyway. What do you think? Do you see some educational opportunities that maybe COVID is opening up that we're not taking advantage of?
I do, and I think that, you know, COVID has revealed a lot of the weaknesses in public education, and I love your idea about, you know, people homeschooling and maybe putting that money toward kids who are being homeschooled. I think that's I think that would be an excellent idea. I think that the right now the teachers union that I don't belong to would be cringing at the thought of that, but I think it's an excellent idea. And you know, part of the reason why I think it's an excellent idea, you're right that I think the money should be following the kid. One of my experiences in education is I worked in a private school for 14 years on the administrative side. And one of the things that I was able to do, one of my responsibilities was to monitor the budget, make sure we didn't go over budget and things like that. And so, you know, I looked at the type of money that private schools tend to spend, and this was a very exclusive private school that I worked at called the Haverford School in Pennsylvania. So it's a very exclusive, pricey school, but they still didn't spend near as much on kids as public schools do on a per child basis. You know, so and they had Olympic sized swimming pool, sports, and when you go to private school, it's like college kind of oriented. Everything was all inclusive. And they actually got to a point where textbooks were included as well in the cost of the school. But what they spent per student and in comparison to their endowment, things like that, is very different than public school.
Well, what do you attribute that to? Where does all that excess money go to in the public sector?
Pensions.
Yeah, that's a big sponge.
That's a big sponge, teachers' pensions and health benefits. And political donations from the union dues go to political donations. But that's where the unions have their power. So it's this circle of evil that goes on inside the education system. You have powerful unions that donate money to political organizations. I mean, they did donate to mostly Democrats. I pointed that out to somebody one time in our little book that they give us every year of endorsed candidates. I pointed out that nearly 100% of them were Democrats, and that's one of the reasons why I'm not in a union, because I don't want my money paying to support Democrat lawmakers. But a lot of people don't realize that. So the unions donate to these political people who keep our budgets high and keep us employed, basically. Keep the teachers employed.
Yeah, and all that money, they get more money every single year, and yet kids are doing worse every year, it seems. In the time that we have left with you, as people may be able to tell, you're not exactly a fan of the Democrats. In fact, outside of your work with Project 21, you've been the vice president of the New Jersey Federation of Republican Women, where you've served also as the regional vice chair. You're also the vice chair of your own particular county. So I recognize that Project 21 is nonpartisan. So if we set that aside, how do we go about getting more blacks and Latinos, both of which I believe are naturally conservative? How do we get more minorities into the Republican Party?
I think we have to keep talking to them and not talking down to them. I think we have to actually invest the time. One of the things that I appreciated about President Trump, there are some things that I didn't appreciate about him, but one of the things that I did appreciate about him was that he's very direct. Yes. In the way he spoke to the African American community. He's like, this program is for black people. Like, we're gonna call the outreach to the African American community Black Voices for Trump, and we're just gonna go for it. And that's something that Republicans tend not to do. So I think that it's very important that we do that. I think that, quite frankly, from a nonpartisan perspective, that we should be talking to people about politics and policy and the importance of voting all the time and importance of being informed. Now, because I'm a card-carrying Republican, I think that everybody should be a Republican. But I think that from a Project 21 and a nonpartisan perspective, I think that we should be educating people. If you're a card-carrying Democrat, a card-carrying liberal, as long as you know what you're talking about, then I'm good with that. But a lot of people don't know what they're talking about. A lot of people are not well informed about their party platform. A lot of people, I will say to people all the time, have you read the Bible, the Constitution, and your party's platforms? Have you read all three of those things? If you haven't, if you're not sure about what your party's platform is, though, you know, I have a friend who calls herself a Republicrat, she's an African-American woman, self-made millionaire from scratch, from nothing. And like I said, she calls herself a Republicrat who didn't know that the government has money that pays for abortions. She had no idea.
Wow.
She happens to be not necessarily a pro-lifer, but she's personally pro-life, put it that way. She would never do it, but you know, she doesn't believe in stopping other people from getting abortions. But she's like, I don't want my money going to pay for that. She had no clue. And I said, well, it's in your party's platform, dear.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you not know these things? It's really shocking. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you. Melanie, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. It was an absolute pleasure.
Before we go, I'd like to read a little something from Facebook that I came across on a friend's thread who lives in Oregon, and he was talking about the lack of time his kids were getting with their teachers. He said they only get 2 days a week of contact time and only via Zoom. Another person chimed in and said this, I feel very fortunate. I live in North Dakota. I have a high school student who is a junior. At the end of the 2020 school year, the district announced that they would be offering an online academy with curriculum through Arizona State University. A teacher is assigned from our local school to grade the work, answer questions, etc. My child signed up for this program and works at her own pace. She finished two classes the first semester by November. She likes this program so much, she has requested that she continue for her senior year as well. She has already taken two AP classes this year. The school district is paying for all of this. My child loves working at her own pace and the ability to choose a meatier curriculum. So if North Dakota is doing that, why is Oregon failing our kids? But that mindset of North Dakota, that's what we need across all of government. Find solutions. It's the mindset of making government more responsible and effective. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.